From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today we get the lowdown on the first weekend of the Coachella Music Festival. Then a documentary about the national backlog of rape kits shows how one unexamined case in Los Angeles had tragic consequences in another part of the country.
One of the women in Ohio, Amberly, would not have been assaulted had Helena's kit been tested in a timely manner, and her perpetrator would have been apprehended. He also assaulted his wife, so he was serial in nature.
And Kendrick Lamar is the very first winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Music who is not a classical or jazz artist. The first weekend of Coachella 2018 is already one for the books. Vince Staples and SZA delivered blistering, politicized performances. Nile Rodgers demonstrated his hit-making legacy. And even the YouTube sensation Walmart Yodeling Kid made a cameo. But it was Beyoncé's epic Saturday night performance that set social media ablaze. She brought a marching band and an army of backup dancers and was joined on stage by her husband, Jay-Z, her sister, Solange, and her former partners in Destiny's Child. In short, Beyoncé more than made up for canceling last year's show due to pregnancy. LA Times music critic Michael Wood was at the festival this past weekend, and when we spoke this morning, he set the scene at the start of Beyoncé's performance.
Well, it was massive, and the anticipation was honestly unlike anything I can remember at Coachella. I mean, I've stood before that huge stage waiting for the night's headliner many times, and this time, man, you could just feel it. People were jazzed, and they didn't know what was coming. Beyoncé runs a famously tight ship, makes everybody sign NDAs about what they're doing with her, so word had not leaked out about what this performance was going to look like, what she was going to play, who was going to show up.
You wrote that it was, and I'm quoting you now, maybe the best headlining performance I've ever seen here. So what set it apart? What did she do that a lot of other headliners from past festivals did not?
A couple things. It was the level of thought that went into the thing and how comprehensive it was. This performance was styled as more or less a kind of tribute to historically black colleges and universities and the kind of halftime shows that they'll do at football games at some of those schools. This wasn't like one or two things that she was taking from that tradition. The whole thing was styled with that in mind. Musicians, dancers, the costumes, the skits. You felt like you were stepping into this entire experience that she had designed.
Every Martin Luther King Day at my church, we sing Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is also known as the African American National Anthem. It's an incredible piece of music, both musically and lyrically. Let's listen to a little bit of Beyoncé singing Lift Every Voice, and we're going to talk about it. She's not doing a Beyoncé song. She's doing an incredibly important piece of music about the history of slavery and the struggles of an oppressed class in America. What does it mean, do you think, to a rich white audience to hear her sing that song with those lyrics?
For Beyoncé to come into that environment and do this kind of show, which was a vivid, warm, beautiful assertion of black personhood, black womanhood, black self-determination. I mean, it just blew people's heads off. It was unapologetic. It was unabashed. But it was also inclusive. She does this amazing thing where she'll finish a song, maybe, and she'll be standing, and she'll have a sort of certain expression, and then she'll break into this grin that kind of brings you into what she's talking about. I think it's about making herself approachable and making herself understood. I mean, she's kind of the genius of that.
It sounds as if this was as much a concert as it was a musical, that it was like something you could see on Broadway in terms of the production value, the number of dancers, the number of players. How does that work economically? Is she producing this? Is Coachella producing it? Because we saw a story earlier that Cardi B was paying almost $300,000 out of her own pocket to stage her show. Is this a lost leader for Beyonce?
I don't know. I've heard numbers thrown around about what Coachella performers can make. And I think it's generally regarded to be in the millions of bucks. What is interesting is Coachella happens 2 weekends. We may never see this performance again. She's going on tour later this year with Jay-Z, but she may not even use parts of this performance, which means you have this kind of crazily ambitious one-off for two shows.
Let me ask you this last question. Everybody who wasn't there this past weekend, who cares, will go second weekend. Outside of Beyonce, what's an act that you would call out? May not be on everybody's radar. Say, these guys killed it. You should absolutely check them out as well.
You know who I really loved was Nile Rodgers of the great, enduring disco band Chic is at Coachella this year. And I think Coachella, what it's trying to say is, hey, you know all these young acts that you like? Well, here's where this stuff comes from. What I really loved about the Chic show was that Nile Rodgers talked about his music. He contextualized it. He talked about the way it assisted him in battling cancer in the last few years. And so it was kind of like Beyonce. There was so much joy in the performance and so much optimism that it wasn't just about, oh my God, this guy's done so many hits. David Bowie, Let's Dance, Diana Ross, I'm Coming Out, Chic's Good Times. It wasn't just that. It was, you saw how this music mattered in his life as a person. And I found it really moving.
Michael Wood is the music critic for the Los Angeles Times. Michael, always a treat to have you on the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you, John.
And now, for 19 seasons, Law & Order SVU has been telling fictional stories from inside a special victims unit at the New York Police Department. And in that time, viewers have written letters to star Mariska Hargitay about their own real-life sexual assaults.
And at first it was a few, then it was more, then it was hundreds, and then it was thousands. A majority of them included some version of, I've never told this to anybody before. And here I was, an actress on a TV show, getting these letters, and I was immersed in these issues. So I educated myself, and I got involved. To me, the Rape Kit backlog is the clearest and most shocking demonstration of how we regard these crimes.
The Rape Kit backlog is the subject of a new documentary that Hargitay co-produced called I Am Evidence. It premieres tonight on HBO. The film visits Detroit, Cleveland, and Los Angeles to investigate why so many rape kits have gone unprocessed and uninvestigated. Hargitay made the film with her SVU colleague, Trish Adlesic. She previously made Gasland. It's an Oscar-nominated documentary about fracking. Adlesic is a producer and co-director of I Am Evidence, and I reached her today in New York. But let's hear first from Kim Worthy. She's a prosecutor in Michigan who's determined to ensure that every kit is tested.
DNA testing can identify an unknown perpetrator. It can confirm the presence of a known suspect. It can affirm a survivor's account of their assault. It can connect the suspect to other crime scenes, even those in other states and jurisdictions. And it can help solve other cases that may not even be sexual assaults. It can also, and this is very important, exonerate the innocent. Bottom line, a rape kit can bring justice.
So what is Kim doing, and why is she an important voice in this film?
Well, Kim really is the reason why, you know, one of the largest reasons why we wanted to make this film. When Mariska met her testifying before Congress about this issue in 2009 and 10, there was an immediate connection and wanting to support each other. And Kim, you know, she's a little bit like the Lone Ranger. I mean, she had no support at all, and she made it her mission to really bring attention to this in a way that was such a magnificent priority and sent the message across the country as a prosecutor in this country saying that this matters and we need to do something about it. And the findings are staggering. At this point, the Detroit backlog in testing these kits, they've gotten over 833 serial rapist hits. And so Kim, her leadership, has sent the message to other prosecutors across the country to see the results and the importance of this. And, you know, she has really dedicated all of her free time and as much time as she can within the city of Detroit as a prosecutor to send this message and to do the right thing and to make Detroit and Michigan a safer place, but also to give women the respect and the justice that they deserve. And there are many, many kits. They found hits and are still in the process of trying these cases.
I think it's fair to say that every rape kit tells a story, and the story is horrifying of what has happened to almost exclusively women and what the women have had to go through after they have been raped in order to collect evidence for the rape kit, the pelvic examination, everything else that follows. And the rape kits in some ways are kind of physical manifestations of the trauma that these women have gone through and the fact that their cases are ignored and neglected. You have so many images of box after box after box of rape kits that are in abandoned warehouses. They're thrown in with other kind of random evidence, that the rape kits themselves become almost a visual representation of the fact that nobody seems to care about what these women have gone through.
Yes, that's historically what's happened in this country, sadly, and most tragically for people impacted by this violence. You know, it sent the message, you don't matter. This is not a priority, and we don't care. And, you know, Nick Kristof, to quote him, you know, he has a quote about when you have stacks of physical evidence and you do nothing with it, that is the crime. And so we can get these perpetrators off the streets, and we can prevent this from happening to someone else. In the film, you know, one of the women in Ohio, Amberly, would not have been assaulted had Helena's kit been tested in a timely manner, and her perpetrator would have been apprehended. He also assaulted his wife driving back from Los Angeles across the United States. So he was serial in nature.
I want to play a clip from the film, and this is a female law enforcement official who is talking about the delay in getting a kit tested and what it meant to a future victim. And she gets really emotional talking about this because I think she feels, as somebody whose job it is to protect people, that the system has failed the people that she is supposed to be helping protect. Let's listen to what she has to say.
Shortly after I had put Charles Courtney in jail, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department called me in reference to a case that they had with Helena that occurred in 1996, and they had just received a hit that Charles Courtney was also their perpetrator. I faxed them everything I had and thought that they were going to go ahead and proceed with Helena's case. But there was nothing. I didn't hear anything back until about 2011. From what I understand, Helena was still pushing for some resolve on it. A decade on a case that could have been resolved for her. A decade that a police department wasted and not taking care of its business.
You know, finding Michelle Breton, she's a retired Fairfield, Ohio police officer, and she was so incensed that she had sent the data confirming everything for the L.A. Sheriff's Department, and they did nothing with it. And to come back so many years later to say, send it again, Helena's still pushing, you know, we can't look the other way now, it was outrageous, because had they done it in the time frame that Michelle sent along the materials from the case, they would have been able to prosecute Helena's perpetrator for her sexual assaults. And as a result of them not properly handling that evidence, her perpetrator was not able to be convicted for her assaults. And that was so damaging for Helena, so upsetting.
And what are some of the defenses that cities like Los Angeles are offering about why they haven't done enough with these rape kits?
Well, in Helena's case, they told her that it fell through the cracks. And that wasn't acceptable to any of us. I mean, Los Angeles did test their untested rape kits. They did test them. But the problem there was why the findings and the convictions were so low And when we look carefully into that, there were things like exceptional clearance, overuse of exceptional clearance, which would be to, you know, say that the victim or the perpetrator was deceased and there was nothing more they could do with the case. It was something that they didn't really want to deal with this and really have to go the extra mile and really see these cases through. And I think by testing, they were hoping that, you know, the public would back down and leave them alone, that, look, we tested these kids and nobody would really look at the findings. And so when we were making the film, you know, I sought after the reports between the sheriff's department and the police department, and we could only find a confirmation of 6 convictions. And there was a limited explanation for that. I mean, I repeatedly reached out to the prosecutor's office to ask for an explanation, and we really didn't receive much information that helped us understand why this was the case.
We're talking with Trish Adlesic. She's the co-director and producer of the HBO documentary I Am Evidence. Outside of testing untested rape kits, it feels like law enforcement could do something fundamentally different, and that is change their perspective of rape. There's a tendency that you highlight of law enforcement tending to either disbelieve or discredit the women who are bringing charges of rape. So how do police officers and district attorneys and people in law enforcement start to change the way that they see rape that might lead to better outcomes for these rape kits and preventing serial rapists from remaining on the streets?
The best way to do that is by educating law enforcement in the police academies and to have a curriculum that really helps identify neurobiology of trauma, the way in which someone reports. That's really important. And I think that when we take the decision making and we put protocols in place for people to follow, there's no room for judgment. And the use of this film, you know, having screenings and every police department possible and every prosecutor's office possible, we will really help to create a better understanding. I can't tell you how many people came up to me in the last year during the film festival tour and said, I was that guy. I really didn't believe these women. And this has helped me so much.
Are these men who are coming up to you in law enforcement or just men? What are their backgrounds, or do you know?
A lot of them have been in law enforcement, and they just said they didn't have the education, they didn't have the awareness, there was no training in police academies, and they really didn't know. And so their job was to try to decide if, in fact, the victim was credible. So a lot of them have been law enforcement, which is so illuminating and exciting for us as filmmakers, because we do this work to help people and have a better understanding and to provide a better way for our society. And, you know, these films are great tools. When people don't have the time to really sit and study something, we can bring the in-depth understanding through this documentary. And that's why it's such an important tool.
Trish Adlesic is the producer and co-director with Geeta Ganbahir of the documentary I Am Evidence. It is on HBO this evening. Trish, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, John. It's really been an honor.
The Pulitzer Prizes were announced today, and rapper Kendrick Lamar became the first winner of the Music Award who is not a classical or jazz artist. Lamar, a native of Compton, won for his album titled Damn, which was released a year ago. The Pulitzer Board said the album is a, quote, virtuosic song collection, unquote, that captures, quote, modern African-American life. All 14 tracks on Lamar's album have one-word titles, including Pride, Lust, Fear, and God. Those song titles and the album's release on Good Friday last year reflect Lamar's exploration of redemption and reconciliation. Irvin Weathersby explored the album's religious symbolism in an essay that he wrote for Esquire magazine, and I spoke with him last year when the album was released. We began with the first track from Lamar's album called Blood.
Is it wickedness?
So I want to ask you about the religious symbolism that you spotted in this song.
Well, I guess when I first heard it, it struck me in terms of the incantations. It seems like, you know, there's chanting and there's some sort of resonance to the words. And so it feels transcendent in some ways.
It also feels like there is an element of the Good Samaritan story here, that Kendrick approaches to help a woman and she shoots him and tells him that he is in fact the loser.
Yeah. And so I think that is one of the primary themes that he's trying to kind of grapple with, this idea of being a Good Samaritan, being a good person, but then you're being struck by the world and all of the world's vices and all of the things that I guess can impede one's progress. And obviously he's talking about death, but I think it's more of a figurative death, right? This is death that he is trying to grapple with in his own life, his own sins.
I want to play a little bit from the song Feel next.
Ain't nobody praying for me. Ain't nobody praying for me.
Nobody praying for me.
Ain't nobody praying for me.
So how much of this is Kendrick Lamar as somebody in the pulpit, and how much of it is somebody in the congregation listening to the preacher?
Well, I think it's both, which makes the album genius. We're able to be him in terms of appreciating and embracing his suffering by reflecting on our own. And it's one of my favorite tracks on the album, because you get the real sense of despair that you're looking for help. You're looking for salvation, and who's going to help you? And then in some ways he tries to figure out, well, how can I help myself? So I think that's the beauty of it, that he is both the preacher and a parishioner.
The thing that's amazing, too, about the record is you can kind of read into it what you want to read into it. It is not too didactic. I want to talk about a song called Yah. Let's listen a little bit to this song.
First on my list, I can't resist. Yah. Everyone together now, know that we forever buzzing. Radars is buzzing. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I have to say, I was driving to school this morning with my 12-year-old, and I said to him, what does the ya-ya mean? He goes, it just means yes, yes, yes. And then I read your essay, and it maybe means Yahweh, Yahweh, Yahweh. Are there different ways of reading the songs depending on where you're coming from?
Absolutely. And I think that's the beauty of art, ultimately, right? The artist produces a product, and the listener or the audience really has full purview to interpret it as they like.
Let's talk about a very clearly message song on the album. It's called Fear, and it features a voicemail recording from Kendrick Lamar's cousin, Carl Duckworth. And it's a bit of a sermon, and there are also references to Deuteronomy. Let's listen to Fear.
I don't think I can find a way to make it on this earth.
What's up, family? Yeah, this is your cousin, Carl, man. Just giving you a call, man. I know you've been having a lot on your mind lately, and I know you feel like, you know, people ain't been praying for you. But you have to understand this, man, that we are a cursed people. Deuteronomy 28:28 says, the Lord shall smite thee with madness and blindness and astonishment of heart.
So you've written in the past about what hip-hop can teach us and its value as an educational tool. What would you say are the larger messages that Lamar is trying to give his listeners with this album?
I think ultimately he is trying to insert this idea that salvation is important. It seems to really be in some ways paradoxical within the hip-hop framework. Hip-hop traditionally seems like it's supposed to be glamour and glitz and selling albums, but that's not really his focus. And in some ways, he feels that he has to share this message. And that message is we need to come to terms with ourselves, with our sins. But it's not so preachy in a sense that it's not something that you want to push away from. So I think that's the genius, because the music is still strong. The music is still hip hop. It's still heavy bass. It's still those things that make you want to nod your head. But I think as you listen to the album over and over, these messages start to seep in.
Irvin Weathersby is a writer and lecturer at Queensborough Community College. His review of Kendrick Lamar's new album in Esquire is called The Book of Kendrick, How Damn Transcends Religious Symbolism in Hip Hop. Irvin, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Kendrick Lamar made a surprise appearance at Coachella on Friday, performing briefly with both Vince Staples and SZA. I don't know if he'll be back this weekend, but you can catch him on May 10th and 11th when his tour comes to the Forum in Inglewood.
This what God feel like. Yeah. Laughing to the bank like, ah.
Among the other Pulitzer Prize winners are playwright Martina Majdzak for her play Cost of Living, and the New York Times and the New Yorker share the Public Service Award for uncovering and reporting on the Harvey Weinstein story. And that's all we have for today. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.
All I wanna be was a gunman. Shooting up the charge, better run, man.